Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining. Welcome to the second class on the Sefira course called Self-Accounting. We're ready to start the second class titled Gavura, Do I Accept My Child for Who She or He Is or Push for More? If you'd like to listen to last week's class on Chesed, so then you can go to the our Mayon website. The audio is on the website. The video, until we get these things straightened out, is on our Mayon Facebook page. Tonight's class as well is recorded and also recorded live, so you can go over there to join. Again, I thank everyone for coming, and Be'ezus Hashem, next class is going to be the following Tuesday at 8 o'clock. Thanks, and I give it over to Rabbi Zirkind.
Makes life a little easier. There was two observations from last week's class was that there was too much giving, there was too much chesed, as my father-in-law put it. There was an overload, and there was maybe more of just reading off a paper than actually going through the idea in depth. And another thing that other people mentioned was that maybe these types of topics should be more interactive instead of it being a monologue where I just talk for whatever the duration of the time. If people feel they want to interject with a question or a comment or clarification, that it'll make it a little bit more meaningful, but more clear and give a certain deeper understanding. So you have the handout that is a general outline of the class. I don't know how much of the actual outline I'll cover, unlike last week, or how much of it will be in this order. I'm just trying to focus on the ideas as much as possible, but I do highly recommend looking at it, either now or later. The last page especially, where I put together a chart with my wife's help about the healthy Gevurah and unhealthy Gevurah. Maybe we'll touch on some of the points, but these are, this is, in a way, it's a synopsis of a lot of what we're talking about in the class. Okay, so last week we mentioned that where we truly find ourselves in the sense of who we really are, is only discovered within our emotions. Talking about the time of Sefira is a time when we're getting in tune with ourselves, we're transforming the negative self-image, or the false, as we called last week, the created self-image, and utilizing the true identity of ourselves to really discover and become aware of who we really are. And we use the difference between I versus ego, as ego being this negative connotation, relating to ourselves in a certain false identity, versus I is the true anoichi, the true me. That's what we're trying to get into. And as we said, that Pesach is the beginning stages of where we first move away from the chometz, from the ego, from the negative relationship to the of our identity. And then through the process of removing ourselves a little bit, we get a better handle, a more of an objective handle on ourselves. And we go through the process of chesed, which is the first week of Pesach. The first midah that we deal with in Sefira is chesed. This week it's already netzach. That actually starts tonight. It's interesting how the series has worked out, that Tuesday nights is the beginning of a new counting. Then once we move into the next week, which is after Pesach, it's Gvura. And Gvura is where already there's enough, so to speak, distance that we had from the negative the dangers of the ego, to be able to now get in tune with our truer, more real self and utilize, if you want to say, a healthy ego, a healthy self-confidence in identifying who we are. And emotions are the medium. Through exploring and through working with our emotions, on one level, our emotions are very strong. As we mentioned last week, they're rooted much deeper in ourself and much harder to change. And we all know that a true person, a real person, a good person, is one who's judged by their character, by their midos, by their emotions, the way they relate to other people. They could be the greatest genius, they could be a very, very intelligent person, but if they don't know how to relate to people, then they're not acknowledged for being a good person, and in society they don't really work so well. Sometimes it actually works that way, that the more intelligent you are, the more distant and removed you are from reality, and your emotions, so to speak, your relationships to people take a big hit. So we explored this idea a little bit more last week, this idea of emotions having this power. And we said that really chesed, we spoke about relationships last week, in chesed we find a very deep self, because when you have to give to someone else, it really represents a true understanding and a relationship to yourself to be able to give. You know, there's a line, in order to accept someone else, you have to accept yourself. In order to give to someone else, you have to give to yourself. And that is an indication of understanding who you really are. This week, when we're focused on the midah, the emotion of gevurah, the attribute, whichever word you want to use, of gevurah, we are really dealing with the other half of chesed. If chesed is giving, or if chesed is this relationship nurturing process, there's an automatic fallout, as we spoke about last week, about healthy relationships, unhealthy relationships, but there's a natural result that comes out of this, and that is, what allows there to be a proper merging, a proper development in a relationship, especially when the relationship is predicated on this give and take, where there has to be a certain amount of giving to the other person. And in this context, giving doesn't just mean love, but it means direction, nurturing, developing. And at the same time, also allowing yourself to receive from the relationship and getting yourself, developing yourself. Here the giving and receiving is not so much giving love and receiving love, but giving direction and receiving as a result direction. As the Gemara says, that one of the great Tanaim said, that I've learned much from my teachers, I've learned much more from my colleagues, and I've learned the most from my students. Because at the end of the day, the student brings out a much deeper appreciation of what you're giving, but it forces you to go deeper within yourself and bring something out which you prior didn't know. If you're learning in a class and your teacher's describing something, or you're the one who's teaching and you understand the idea on some level, and then a student raises their hand and the student says, you know, asks a question, and you didn't even think about it. It could be a very simple question. It's, by the way, the beauties of teaching children, is that a child automatically thinks different than most adults, unless the adult is a child. But even then, the brain that we developed is more sophisticated, is more abstract, and therefore, as a result, we miss the simple. So we could be learning a mimer, a gemara, an idea in nature, and we're getting caught up in the abstract idea, and the child could notice they're very observant about the details, because their mind captures the here and now much better. Even though they may have a better imagination, but they capture it here. So they'll ask you a simple thing. How does this work? It doesn't work with the reality. That's why Rashi always says, I'm coming to explain something to a ben chomish lomikra, to a five-year-old child. Because a five-year-old child is going to look at pshutish. He doesn't know the abstract ideas. He just knows the simple story. And the simple stories, and a lot of times, there's no proper flow. At any rate, so the student is going to ask a question to the teacher, so it usually comes from the fact that the teacher is much more removed and more abstract or more deep or much more intellectually advanced, and as a result, the student asking this question challenges the teacher to now look at the information from a whole new perspective, and as a result penetrates, makes the teacher go deeper within himself or within herself to find the answer. The true depth only comes about when we're pushed. There's a very interesting Hayoyim Yoyim, or the booklet that the Lubavitcher Rebbe put out on each day. There's a little small piskum from usually his father-in-law, the Friedrich Rebbe, the previous Lubavitcher Rebbe, or from other of the Lubavitch Rebbeim. And one of them is brought down from the previous Rebbe's father, the Rebbe Rashab, the fifth Chabad Rebbe. He asks the question, he says, how is it that the Gemara, when the Gemara wants to analyze certain arguments between, let's say, two litigants, two people in court, or between a husband and a wife, the Gemara gives such deep, rational, logical, intellectual answers that even a simple person, a woman, a child, could come up with. And it seems to be a little bit not understood. How do they come up with these deep answers or these deep arguments? And the way the Rebbe Rashab, the Fifth Chabad Rebbe, answers, he says something which is negeya, something which is, it touches your deeper inside, you get the answer. There's a deeper core that pulls, that forces out a much deeper self. And we know how this works when we're forced on the spot. A lot of times, you know, you're challenged with a question, and you know you have to give the answer, automatically you come up with an answer. You have no idea where it came from. And if you will be sitting calmly, you're not being challenged, you wouldn't necessarily find the answer with inside of you. So the power or the depth of the giving and receiving that we're talking about here is you're nurturing something in someone else. You're developing something in someone else. At the same time, it gives you and it brings back in within you a much deeper, it awakens a much deeper core. That's the concept of what we're talking about tonight. As a result of the giving and the receiving that we spoke about last week, about chesed, the love angle, then there's also the giving and receiving when it comes to the nurturing angle. Because there's a fundamental difference between chesed and gvura. Chesed is much more natural than gvura. Chesed means where the person, if you're a kind person, one of the more famous lines is teva hatoiv lahetiv. The nature of good is to do good. The nature of someone who's chesed is to do chesed. Avraham Avinu, for example, was known for his midas hachesed, for being a very kind, giving person. And the pasuk says that when God commanded him to bring up his son Yitzchak on the Akedah, and then God obviously told him, you know, I didn't really mean that you slaughter him. I mean that, you know, just I wanted to see how far you listen to me, whatever the story. We're not going to get into the theological questions of the story. But the point is that afterwards the pasuk says, Atu yadati, now I know ki yorili kimata, that you are also fear God. And as explained, because the fact that Avram had the midas hachesed, the fact that he was kind, that was natural. That was his personality. The gevura part, the fact that he was willing to go deeper within himself and find a place of like absolute faith and belief in God or commitment to God, to be even willing to sacrifice his son, that idea was something that was only exposed through this challenge, through this nisayon that God gave him. And so therefore chesed, even if it's not your personality, even if you're not necessarily naturally a kind, giving person, either you're more stingy, you're more reserved, whatever it may be, but the nature of giving, whatever the reasons are, psychologically, you know, philosophically, spiritually, the nature of chesed is a lot easier of a process to do than this nature of gvura. Gvura is a much deeper process within oneself. It forces a person to go much deeper and to bring out something much stronger. In a way, gvura has a correlation to netzach, which is, as I said, this next week in Sfira, starting tonight. There's a very strong correlation between gvura and netzach, and actually on the netzach class that we will be having in 2 weeks, the question is, does competition bring out the best or worst in me? And there is this correlation between gvura and netzach. We're not going to get into the differences between the two. One of the major differences is, just to touch on the point, gvura is finding, penetrating deep within myself. Netzach is overcoming. Okay? So we're not going to touch upon that, but Netzach means to overcome an obstacle. Gevura doesn't mean you're overcoming something, you're just penetrating deep within yourself. But the point of the class is not to distinguish between the two, I'm just making that observation now. So that topic, that result of where I'm giving and receiving, whether giving love and receiving love, or giving direction, nurturing, developing, and therefore receiving on the same, and that nurture, is the question that we're dealing with this week. And it's a big question because of the fact that we all are in that position. We're all in a position of hashpa, of influencing, whether it's in a positive influence of chesed or a positive influence of gvura. We're all in a position that we have to give, we have to direct, we have to educate, whether we're parents, whether we're siblings, whether we're teachers, whether we're just human beings that interact with other human beings, we're automatically directing, nurturing, developing, because the nature of human beings is that we're incomplete. We don't master ourselves in life, because if we have mastered ourselves, then God doesn't need us in this world anymore. That's why the Pasuk says that if a person lives until 70 years, im begvurais shmoinim shana, and if he reaches the age of gvurais, 80 years, the maximum person, the Pasuk says, will live is 80 years. Why does the Pasuk use the word v'im b'gvurais, gvura? Because gvura here identifies when the person has already reached his state of ultimate development. And as we're going to see, we're talking about a gvura. Gvura means developing, as we've spoken about already, touched on this point. Gvura, so when are you reached the point of gvuras? When could you give yourself this adjective of being a gibor? Of someone who's reached the level of gvuras, that's only when you fully developed yourself. And that's what we said. That's 80 years. And then the person, at least in the Pasuk's description, doesn't have any purpose in this world anymore. So we're constantly developing. We're constantly learning. We're constantly being nurtured from within and from without. So how does it work? What's the process? What should be the objective here? That's one general question. Even within ourselves, we're developing. What's the expectations we have for ourselves? How do we go about developing ourselves? We all have grandiose visions. We want to be, you know, a healthy human being. We want to be a good giver. We want to be someone that's a loving person. So on and so forth. We seek proper or healthy morals and ethics and beliefs and ideals, and we want to try to nurture them within ourselves. What's the proper healthy approach? This is all included in this topic that we have, that of Gvura. We don't have the time to go through every single one and analyze them, but we're going to mainly focus on the relationship between children and parents, or parents educating children, because this is probably the greatest example, and unfortunately, it's the example that could go the most wrong. You know, no child comes with a manual book. You know, parents sometimes have to screw up on the first few children until they get the hang of how to educate. It's an unfortunate reality. But you see how children, the older ones, get sometimes a rougher end than the younger ones. And not necessarily does it mean that the younger ones get anything better. Maybe just the parents get too old and they don't have any more patience to really be too harsh on them, whatever it may be. But this is one of the bigger issues. And it's so crippling and so destructive within a child's health and development, and also for the parents' health and development, that if it's not done properly, there could be a lot of backlash and negative results out of this. So we're going to focus primarily on this idea of gvura, on this element of the relationship between parent and child. And the topic is, how do I accept my child for who she is, or do I push for more? When we are talking about the midah of gvura, so... You know, on the paper, I have a few definitions over here. I write gvura, strength, it's intensity, it's judgment, it's heroism. David says about Yoinasan, Eich noflu giboirim, right? How have the heroes fallen? How have the mighty fallen, which usually refers to the heroes' fear? But it's primarily the tool of development. When we want to put this all together, gvura is the power or the tool to enable proper development and growth. That's what gvura is, if we want to conceptualize the idea. And as we'll see, hopefully we'll get into the idea of how we see God, how the Eibishur uses Gvura. We know very much, we know that whenever we describe that God's great hand, his Yad HaChazaka, or his power, his might, his Gvura represents an educational element to it. Either educating us from the fact that we were doing bad, or punishing, which we all know that punishment from God doesn't mean punishment in the sense of that he's trying to get revenge, because God doesn't need revenge. It means he wants to educate us. He wants us to understand how to become better people. So sometimes the way to educate is by, you know, if the child wants to go next to the fire and he's going to put his hand in the fire, you say, don't go there. And if they still don't get the message, sometimes you have to physically pull their hand away. So likewise, God uses that gevura. So gevura here may be a certain power, a certain strength, but it's also it's part of this process of education, of enabling development. Likewise, we find this idea of ezuhu gibor, who's considered a true gibor, hakoyve shes yitzroi, someone who overcomes his inclinations and so on and so forth, which is again this idea of developing. The Mishnah calls it gibor because strength, this idea of gibor represents this idea of development. That's the main I would say the conception. I could be wrong, you could disagree with me, but the way I understand what Gvur is, and that's why the topic has been chosen. But as I have here in the introduction, I just want to touch on something which is maybe a little cute, which I thought may be interesting, and that is that when we're speaking about emotions, so I would venture to say that most people don't feel like they have a handle on emotions. That's probably the hardest field for people to really, once we get emotional, there's a line that I like using, is that we don't like feeling that we're human beings. We have an issue with feeling that we're human beings. When we get angry, upset, when we get, you know, too much in a mode of us being too human, we, so to speak, get angry at ourselves for being human. And that is part of the process of developing also, is the fact that we have to appreciate that we have to appreciate our humanity. But emotions is the most difficult side of us. We said it's the deepest and the most real element, but it's the hardest one to have a handle on. And the way it's described in Kabbalah and Chassidus is this idea of a musical instrument, a harp. The Gemara says in Erchin that the harp that was played in the Beis HaMikdash was a 7-string harp. And when Mashiach comes, it'll be an eighth string. It'll be the eighth note. Today we only have 7 notes. It'll be the eighth note. This idea of the 7-string harp correlates to the 7 emotions, starting from Chesed all the way down to Malchus. Likewise, the Zohar says something very fascinating. The Zohar in Parshas, I think it's in Parshas Pinchas, the Zohar says that each one of our 10 powers of the soul correlates to a different, I called it here, pitch, a different type of either pitch or octave of music. And the pitch or octave of music of Gvura is Zmirais. Zmirais is a compound word that comes from the word either zarmum, or comes from the word, if you take around the word, rozmum. Gvura has this dual element in it that has this paradox. It could be a roz, it could be a deep secret, it could reveal something very powerful within us, or it could be a mum, it could lead to blemish. So I have here written, music could make us or it could break us. You could have motivating music or you could have depressing music. There is no greater tool in our physical existence as of now to express our emotions, and that really indicates what our emotions are. The real stringing of the harp that really pulls us into a certain directions is music. Music has a pull within us. That's part of the reason why we have to stay away from non-Jewish and unclean music, because it has an effect on us. Over my years of experience with, you know, teenagers and above, older guys or whatever, discussing different issues and, you know, trying to working on ourselves. So a lot of times the question becomes, how bad is it to listen to non-Jewish music? And you could argue from halachic point of view that it's not so bad, or certain musics that we think are bad are not so bad, and so on and so forth. But then it comes to a different angle, which we call the hashkafic or machshava point of view. And that is, let's be honest, what happens when you listen to certain non-Jewish music? What does it do to you 5 minutes later? Does it motivate you to open up a Gemara and start learning? Does it motivate you to want to do someone a favor? Or does it start making you imagine all your desires, how you want to fulfill your desires? Or you want to become a singer? You want to become a movie star? Does it make you want to stay in bed longer? What's the result of listening to the music? If we're really in tune within ourselves, we'll see in tune, we will begin to appreciate how music has such a deep effect on us. And the reason is because music, as emotions, are the same chords. They play the same things. If you string them the right way, if you play the music in a certain way, it creates one emotion. You play it in a different way, it creates another emotion. And that's the harp of the soul. That's the kinar. Kinar is also a compound word of chof vav, 26 ner, candle, which is an idea also explained in Kabbalah and the Pardes and Kotei Torah, that which represents the idea of God, which is in the number of chof vav, of 26. God uses letters of his name, Yud Kei Vav Kei, is 26. The energy of God is in ner, is in a candle, which is in, where it says, ner havai in nishmas adam, the candle of God is the soul of man, that our candle, meaning our soul, has within it these four letters. These four letters is God's, you know, emotion speaking through within us. And when we're stringing the harp, when we're going through this array of emotions, we're, so to speak, getting these same, we're having the same effect on God's emotions, and that's why there's the reciprocative element of Midah Keneged Midah, and so on and so forth. So when we're dealing with Midas HaGvura, as the Zohar calls it, that the Midah of Gvura is Mirais, it really has this power. It could either make us, it can motivate us, proper Gvura, proper development, proper nurturing could really develop and make us and make our children, make our environment better, or it could break us, it could destroy us. Many years ago, I was planning on going to get smicha, and I was thinking of going to, which I ended up going to, a smicha program in Australia at the time, in Melbourne, Australia, and it was known for being a very vigorous, very intense year of learning and very highly, you know, the academic level and so on and so forth. It was a very vigorous process. And I had a few brothers that went before me that were there. So I asked them, what did they think? You know, is it something to do or should I try it or not? So one of my brothers said, it could either make you or it could break you. Very deep insight that I only obviously appreciated after I went. I don't know if it made me or broke me, but the point is that certain environments of development, certain pressurized situations could either push us deeper and therefore bring out this gevura element, this hakoivishas yisrei, this nurturing of our deeper self, or it could do just the opposite, it completely breaks us. And one of the fundamental points in this is a concept that I also have here somewhere, is know thyself, know thy child. In any form of development, in any form of giving or nurturing, you have to fully understand who you are, your personality, the way you relate to things, what drives you, what you feel is good, what you understand to be right, and at the same time understand that of your child or of the person you're trying to educate or nurture. A lot of times we impose ideas that we believe in. A father thinks, I want my child to be, you know, a doctor, a lawyer. And the child is brought up with this feeling that they have to be a doctor or a lawyer. But their personality doesn't work with being a doctor or a lawyer, or their talents don't work with being a doctor and a lawyer. That's not who they are. So you haven't nurtured the true talent or potential of this child. In fact, you squashed and held back. You suppressed their full development of who they really are. Their crucial years of growth have been constantly been bombarded with something which is not them. There's a certain intuition we have to understand of our child. We have to be able to relate to them and understand them. We also have to be willing to hear from them what is the truth to confirm our intuitions. These are basic ideas of when we're discussing this development, this parenting, this relationship, the necessities of this relationship, of how deep it goes. Is it going to make the person? Am I trying to make the person? Or am I going to end up breaking the person and destroying the person? And I don't think that we have to go too far to give examples of people that have come across either within their own family, within themselves, or with people that they've interacted with, either as a parent or as a child, of both ends of this issue of zmiris, of either making or breaking. Zmiris could either be a roz, a secret, a deep revelation of itself, or it could be a mum, it could be a blemish. Or as another way the Zohar puts it, if you put together zmiris, you rearrange the word, it comes to the word mamzeris, which is a very deep understanding of children. Turn out that the parent is the one that causes the child to be a bastard, and it wasn't the child's fault at all, but it's the parent's fault to begin with, which is a very deep insight in the power of Gvura here. But Zohar doesn't say all that I just said. That's my understanding of it. Okay. So when we begin with this process, so we find right away in the Torah says, Nasa adam etzalmeinu kidmusenu. God says when he wanted to make man, he said, let's make man in our image. There's a certain realization that when you're coming to make a man, you're coming to develop, and you're trying to nurture, there's an automatic understanding of there's a certain set of pre-existing, what we want to call universal accepted truths. I don't know why they're accepted necessarily. That's a different story. But let us say that these accepted truths are truths. Certain norms, certain natures, certain morals, certain beliefs, certain ethics, which are universally accepted, which come before the child, which are already in place. When the child is born, the child doesn't have these naturally, innately within them. The pasuk describes as a human being when he first starts developing, kilev ha'adam nar ra min urav, that the nature of a child, the nature of us human beings, is to be sort of wild or even maybe bad. Our natural disposition is to actually have unrefined character, undeveloped character. And leaving aside the famous, argument in the philosophical realms of, whether you believe man was born naturally positive, good, and society screws them up, or the other way around. But Judaism, God believes, the way the Torah describes, is that we actually need to be nurtured in a certain way. There is a necessity. We won't just naturally, all of a sudden, become, moral people. You know, there's such a thing as, what are they called, feral children that live in the forest. They grow up without any education, and they have more of a relationship and more of a symbolism to an animal than to a human being. If we wouldn't be educated, if we wouldn't be nurtured, we would look like them as well. Not just because of the fact that we don't have a human being on top of us, but the basic nature of man is animalistic. We know that it's explained in many places that the Jewish soul or the godly soul that Jews possess is not given to man till a little later. We don't fully develop our positive side till much later. And that means that our negative or unhealthy, or I should say undeveloped side, our more natural side, has much more of a power on us, and it's much harder therefore to break free from us. So Nasa Adam etzalmeinu kidmusenu is a necessity, it's an imperative. When you're going to be Nasa Adam, there's a certain salmeinu kidmusenu, there's a certain set of rules that are already in place that have to be instilled in and have to be given over. The problem, though, is how to do it. Again, how do we stimulate a certain positive, harmonious set of musical notes that will produce a motivating feeling and a drive in the child, in the Adam, that they should actually want to do this? I want my child to appreciate that Shabbos is a sacred day. That Shabbos is a time where even though during the rest of the week you're depressed and you feel the only thing you need to do is listen to your music or watch your movies or things like that, when it comes Shabbos, you should appreciate that the best thing for you is actually to be in the spirit of Shabbos. The child doesn't feel that. The child is completely desensitized and insensitive to these things. So what should I do? Should I force my child? Do I impose on my child this idea? Do I say, you have to be here now and this, that, and you watch them like a hawk? How do you make the child feel motivated to want to do it? And not feel despondent and depressed that they have to go through a 24-hour period of one day a week where they're completely miserable and they rather stay in bed and sleep as much as possible, waiting until the moment Shabbos ends because they don't want to be thrown out of their house, or they don't want to be, you know, at this point they're not ready to take on their own independent life. And it may be a very exaggerated example. I don't think so. I think it's a very practical example. But you could all find this even in small things. You know, the child that you want them to appreciate that you come out of the bathroom, you wash your hands. It's not hygienic, whatever it is. You're going to touch other people's food. How do you go about this process? The Chaheinah Sarabis, there's many examples. We do not have to go through a list of examples over here. So, with understanding that there's a necessity of Dinasa Adam Salmenu Kidmusenu, we really have to appreciate that in order to get the child, or as we said, even ourselves, to a point of being able to properly develop and nurture, there's a certain process that has to go, there's a certain direction that's necessary. There's a certain instinct that parents have. I'm not at a parent yet, but I don't think you have to be a parent to appreciate it. I think every person has the instinct whenever they're in a position of education, or more in this case, development, even though education and development are not two different things, but at least as a nurturer of someone's potential. Take, for example, if you're a music teacher and you want to teach someone how to play a certain instrument, there's a certain instinct that you want that student to already be holding at the most perfect level. The biggest challenge for a teacher, an educator, a parent is to be able to is the ability to move back, step back. It's one of the hardest things to do because we instinctively just want it to be there already. You have certain people that their personality is driven by intensity, and the intensity is that they want something to happen. They're constantly focused on the thing getting there already. You know, it's like the person who wants to finish a Masechta, so they're not so preoccupied of knowing, learning the Masechta. Their focus is on finishing the Masechta, so they're just going to bombard it and force all the way through to they finish the Masechta. You have a certain essay you need to write in school. You have to get a test on certain, you know, mathematics or whatever it is. Your objective is to get to the conclusion, and as a result, you don't even begin to appreciate what's necessary in the process to get there. The example that I think could be an illustration to this is the game of baseball. For those who are familiar with the game of baseball, one of the biggest or one of the hardest disciplines for a batter, the guy who's at the plate, right? He's at dinner. He's the guy who's at the plate that is expected to hit the ball. What does he want? What's his expectations? To hit the home run. That's what they want. Every single baseball player goes up to the plate with the want to hit a home run. There's no question about it. The people who are in sports make big deals of the fact that, you know, he shortened his swing in order to just hit a sacrifice fly, for those who appreciate baseball, right? Or just to bump the ball that he can move the runner ahead. What they call playing small ball, right? These ideas are such a restraint on the half of the batter, because all he wants to do is reach his potential. I could hit, you know, the biggest home run. It could go 500 feet. Of all those disciplines, the greatest discipline is patience. Because what happens is the ball is coming in at you at sometimes 95 miles an hour. You have literally a split second or less to decide whether to swing at it or not. The instinct of every single batter is to swing at every pitch, even if it's like up here. There's a certain nature because you want to be successful. You want to, your expectations drive you to want to be successful already. And you see a lot of baseball players who have tremendous talent, but because they haven't mastered the talent of patience, they strike out a lot. They don't accomplish anything. Not only don't they hit the home run, they don't hit a double, and they don't even hit a single, and they don't even get a walk. They strike out. Because when it's all about the ultimate reaching the final conclusion, all about just hitting the home run, and you don't have the appreciation of finding the pitch that will be perfect for you, that will enable you to bring out your potential of hitting the home run, and you get smacked at 500 miles an hour, or whatever it is, then you lose completely. So when we're talking about nurturing, one of the first major necessities is patience. And as I have on the last page over here, healthy gevura is appreciating process-oriented versus unhealthy is goal-oriented. A lot of times, the way in our society today, we're very into the goal. We're very about the goal, making a certain goal and sticking all the way through. So a person has a goal that they want to get a certain degree, whether in smicha, Jewish studies, or a degree in psychology or in mathematics. They have a certain goal. Or their goal is that they want to finish a certain curriculum, a certain subject matter. Or their goal is that they want to become a carpenter or a businessman. Many goals we have. And there's a difference between a goal and a vision, whatever, a dream. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, you set yourself a goal. Or certain people know, let's say they struggle, they watch movies all day. So they set themselves a goal. Their goal is that they're not going to watch movies for the next 2 weeks. Or the greatest example of that is going on a diet. You have a goal, you want to lose 30 pounds. Or you want to gain 20 pounds, if necessary. Right? So you have a goal. The problem with the goal is that the goal is really empty. It doesn't change you. It doesn't really affect you. You never really began to appreciate what you did to reach the goal because it was all about the goal. And a lot of times, even if you're successful in reaching the goal, you're miserable afterwards. Okay, so now what do I do? Now, we do have to distinguish between goals which are based on externals and goals which are based on internals. What I mean by that is if a person has a goal that they want, but they, let's say, want to lose weight, I would say that's probably a healthy thing. If a person has a goal that they want to become a carpenter, I would say that's a healthy goal. Because at the end of the day, you have it, you did it. I mean, with losing weight, it's probably something that after you stopped, you'll probably revert back to whatever and gain back 30 times as much. But the point is that you've accomplished a thing. When you're looking from an internal place, from a development place, trying to develop yourself, you can't say, well, I have a goal that I want to be a kind person. I have a goal that I want to really feel Shabbos every Shabbos. I have a goal that I want to be able to really, when I'm speaking to someone, to be able to really feel the person and relate to the person. Because it's all then, or could all be, just about reaching that point. And there's never the appreciation of what's necessary to go there, the process that's necessary to go there. I had a lot of times with certain students of mine that one of the big issues was that they wanted to already finish. They wanted to complete. You know, they always ask me, how do I get motivated or interested in going through the process of learning the Gemara, learning the Shulchan Aruch, or whatever subject matter it was? And I would say, it's not about the goal. It's not about the test. It's not about finishing something. It's about every stage, every process, every moment of spending with the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch, or with yourself is another stage of development. You're building a greater relationship, a deeper appreciation of self. It's not about me becoming a good person. It's about me appreciating the necessity of how to become a good person. What does it mean to become a good person is not, I don't know what that means. No one knows what that means. But there's a process involved. God doesn't expect us to be perfect. If he did, again, like we said, we wouldn't be here. God doesn't want us to be perfect people. He doesn't want us to reach a goal. In that sense, it's about a process. And especially when you're trying to nurture this in a child, there's a necessity to appreciate that it can't be about, I want my child to be this. And this is usually what I called over here the Baal Tshuva syndrome. And I'm not knocking Chas V'Sholem Baal Tshuvas here. Chas V'Sholem, they're Kaddish and B'mokim Shabali Tshuva in the Mafil Tzadikim Gemurim in Yicholim Lami. The place where the Baal Tshuva stands, no one can stand, even the greatest righteous person. But there sometimes could be a certain missing over there of where the Baal Tshuva, the parent, because of their personal intensity, the way they relate to Yiddishkeit or they relate to certain ideas, is on such an intense, lively, real level, they almost expect that the child should be on that same level. And they want their child to be there. Or they want their child to undo all their misdoings as a child themselves. Which doesn't have to be Baal Tshuva parents, it could be any parent. But again, here, not only is the unhealthiness where you're imposing on the child a lot, you also don't appreciate that even if they have that potential to reach there, there's a massive gulf between where they're starting to where they're going. And it's never about a goal. Don't have goals for your children. It's not about a goal. It's not that I want my child to be this. Yes, we all want our children to be smart, if they're gifted with intelligence. We want them to be, you know, nice people. We have ideas in our minds. We again, there are certain universal accepted truths that we try to instill in our children. But it's not that I want them to be this. I can't view my child as being this. But let me clarify this point, because it may sound like, so I should have no aspirations for my child. I should have no expectations of my child. I should just let them be who they are. And as I have over here, the difference between love and neglect. Laying back and just letting my child be for themselves is not good either. We find something very interesting. The pasuk says, Chanoich l'nar al pi darkei. Shlomo HaMelech says that you have to educate your child based on his way. We find two conflicting ways of explaining this. There's the conventional way of explaining this, which is an idea brought down in the Gemara and by the Rishonim, that Chanoich l'nar al pi darkei basically means, you know, appreciating his uniqueness, his personality, allowing for the individual element of the child to shine forth. Don't try to push the child for something that isn't him. Or even if you're going to try to push the child to being something, appreciate that they need the time. Yaakov, you know, when it came when Yaakov and Lavan, or with Yaakov and Esav, that when Esav comes with his 400 men, and he wanted to kill his brother Yaakov, and then afterwards they made peace, so Yaakov, and Esav tells Yaakov, you know what, I'll walk with you, we're going the same direction anyway, right? Let's walk together. So Yaakov didn't like the idea, he knew he was dealing with an Esav over here, with a bad influence. And the Gemara actually learns from here that if you are in a path with a non-Jew and the non-Jew tells him, let's take a walk together, you're like, you find excuses out of it. But the pasuk says something very interesting. The Yaakov tells Esav, he says, you know, the children are too young. If I push them too much, they're going to die. They can't handle it. Now, this could be obviously in a very, you know, simple way of understanding that don't push your child physically, but it was a very deep insight. Yaakov is saying, I need to nurture my child now. If I'm nurturing my child, it's not about, you know, reaching a destination. It's not about the goal. La'at la'at, the pasuk says. It's a slow process. It's an appreciation of the process. So there's one thing of Chanoich l'nar al pi darkei, is appreciating that there's a person here, an individual with individual talents and individual needs, and likewise, individual time. Not all children are born the same way. Not only are not all children born the same that not born the same way. Every child is born differently, and you can't have the same expectations for all of them. But at the same time, we find almost like there a opposite approach. The Shalom quotes, I think he quotes it from the Ramak even, Rav Moshe Cordovero. He says He says, in a way of like a question, the pasuk says like this, that if you educate a child based on his way, his uniqueness or his nature, so then even when he gets older, it will not go away. In other words, that education, that development will stick with him. So he plays with it. He says, in a way of a question, if you're going to educate the child only based on the child's nature, in other words, you're going to leave the child's nature the way it is, or like I wrote over here, the pasuk that Shlomo says, you know, you spear the rod, you spoil the child. If you're going to say, you know, I'll back off, I'll let my child just develop for himself, I'm not going to impose, I'm not going to instill any norms, any universal acceptance truths, I'm going to have no expectations for my child. So then, even when the child gets older, he won't change. He won't naturally develop into something positive. He won't naturally develop in having a good nature. He won't naturally have expectations for himself. So we see in the very pasuk that describes how we're supposed to educate this duality, this necessity for both, appreciating uniqueness and individualism, appreciating the personality and each one's time, each one's darkoi, but at the same time just letting go, neglecting. And as I have over here, one of the negative associations with parenting is a fear to nurture. You have certain parents which are scared, especially today. One of the biggest problems I could say, I feel, is that parents are afraid to educate. They heard so many stories or they see so many other children going off the path. I'm talking about here in a religious sense. And they're afraid. I don't want my child to go off, so I need to show love. I need to show love. One of the things that I've experienced, again, in my realms of being involved in the number, you know, in this type of field a little bit, is I saw over the past 10 years a major change. In the beginning, the teenagers were very passionate, resentful and angry towards religion, but passionate. There was a fire there. They cared about something. So all you had to do is nurture that intensity, that gevura, that deep wanting for something that's real and true to them, and nurture it in a positive. The problem is today, we have kids that are complacent. They don't care. There's no passion at all. They're completely desensitized to anything because the parents stay back, not mixing in, afraid to open their mouth, afraid to say, you should daven. Afraid to say that it's a good idea to get up in the morning. But what is the proper balance to allow this nurturing to take place? So we're running very late, so I'll try to finish this point by going through a certain process that may be helpful. So I have over here about by mode. So I have healthy mode, which is intensity with patience. As we said, focus on the now. And number two, making space. Allowing for the child to have space. Unhealthy is a slave driver, a micromanager, or imposing. Okay, we don't have to elaborate on these points. But where it really comes to the question is of this balance, of the necessity for balance. This developing of the child. So you have over here the development, so we have of a sapling. The pasuk says a human being is like a tree. When you plant a tree, there's an appreciation of that. The tree needs to be nurtured. It needs to be watered. It needs to be given proper sunlight. It needs to get the proper nutrients for it to develop. But you could either screw up on that plant, neglect it, and it won't grow at all properly. Or you could overwater it and destroy it. There's many ways you could destroy the plant. You could bend it in the wrong way and it'll have that mark on it forever. It's very vulnerable in that stage. And there's a necessity of appreciation of at what stage do we begin imposing or instilling certain norms and certain ideas? At what stage do we allow the child to develop for themselves? What stage do we just allow them to start growing? You know, you're not going to impose on an infant your ideas of what life is about. The Gemara says that you begin, once the kid starts speaking, you start teaching him Torah, Tziva, Lanu, Moshe. But that's usually at the age of 2 or beyond, not when the child is 1 day old. Okay, special tzaddikim, they said that they used to wear yarmulkes even when they were just born, or tzitzis, or things like that. But we all understand that an infant doesn't understand any of this that's going on, right? So there's an appreciation of the ki'adam etzasada, the analogy of us as a tree. So I have over here a number of points which I just want to touch on. We have over here pushing versus pulling. There's a very big difference between pushing and pulling. I'm not going to elaborate on the analogy, but pushing is something when you're behind. You want to nudge them along. The child sees the path ahead of them. They have the independence of making decision. They know that at the end of the day, any decision they're making is their own. They have the clear view ahead of them where they're going. You're nudging them in a certain path. Versus pulling usually refers to you standing in front of the child. And you're not giving them a chance to even see where they're going. All you're doing is just forcing them a certain direction. It's like having an animal on a leash. And the animal wants to go this way and you're going like this. It's like dragging a child. Same idea. And therefore, the point is to appreciate, you have to allow the child to experience these things for themselves. Allow them to realize, obviously we're going to see in a moment a certain age that we're talking about, but allowing to appreciate that there's a certain necessity to let the child experience. Certain teenagers go through challenges, and when they go through challenges, they don't appreciate that you tell them, you know, I was there myself, and I realized how stupid it was. They'll say, yeah, shekoyach, fine, so you went through your experience, now let me have my experience. Don't pull me along. But you could nudge them. You could give them certain pieces of advice. You can make them feel like they have direction when they need to. But allow them to experience. Allow them to test. Allow them to realize themselves. The story of my grandfather, that at a period in his life, he was a chain smoker. So he had his children make the cigarettes for him. They would roll out the cigarettes. And they had a rule in the house that I think it was when you were 12, you're allowed to smoke. And when you were 9, you're allowed to smoke on Purim. Like Purim is one of those days, you know, Avda Befker, Nichale, everything is mutter. And it was one of my uncles, may he be well, Yibodol Chaim Tovim, wanted to, you know, he's a little kid, and he's exciting. He sees, you know, like monkey see, monkey do. He sees his father doing something. He wants to do it also. So he wanted to smoke a cigarette. He must have been 4 or 5 years old. So I heard the story. Obviously, I wasn't there. So my grandfather was appreciated enough what was going on. He saw the way my uncle was approaching the cigarette. He picked up the cigarette, and he put it in backwards. He never picked up a cigarette again. Now, obviously, no one got it. Okay, fine. The part that was lit on fire. You know, he burnt his tongue. Like Moshe and the coals. The point is that you sometimes allow the child to experience these things himself. When he goes through these experiences, that's the greatest educational tool you could give them. Ein chacham kebal hanisoyin. Another point is universal virtue versus individualism. We have great ideas in life. Many ideas that we were told to as ourselves as children. A lot of them could be right, but they don't necessarily match with this particular individual child. You know, there's a concept in halacha that in certain cases, we look at the individual. The individual sometimes becomes the exception, and we appreciate the exception. Just because it's right for you doesn't mean it's right for him. Just because it works for you doesn't mean it works for him or her. External influences versus internal personality, or potential, I'm sorry. How much do you want the child to be exposed to the outside world? And how much do you want them to grow what they really have? Unfortunately, today, this is a big problem. We are so much influenced by the world around us, whether it's with TV, movies, radio, books. There's so much external influence. Parents bring in external influence. And there's never an appreciation, and it could be even positive. I gave bad example or examples of bad or negative things. It could be good examples. Certain ideas in life that people have. People have written thousands of books of the best way to educate, or the best ideas, or the best this, or the best that. And you got inspired as a parent or as an educator. But there's a certain individual talent that's latent much deeper. You know, you usually find this, the difference between extroverts and introverts. You know, an introvert may be look shy, but they got a very deep creative side, an inventive side. Allow them to nurture that also. Don't just force upon them other ideas that you have to do. Today's society, part of the, I feel at least, part of the problem in the educational system is that they focus on one part of the body, and on that part of the body, a single pathway. They focus on the brain and only a specific pathway of logical ways of thinking. The people that learn through creative jumping around or other things, they completely ignore. So we have is a certain suppression of the true personality to impose another personality upon them. No appreciation of the individualism. But again, there has to be a balance of both. Because if you just allow the child to just develop their own personality or their own potential, they could be missing a lot otherwise. Or it could lead them to a very negative place. Yeah, people have great creative visions or great, you know, artistic ability, but were never nurtured how to be a human being. That's sometimes a problem as well. So what is a process to appreciate? I have here a few other ideas, you know, guidance versus independence. In other words, education versus allowing them to make the choices, as we spoke about before. So just on the last few minutes, just to give a perspective over here, and obviously when talking about balance, there's a necessity to understanding this. And there's no greater person to learn this from the Eibishter. Achrei Abayim Teleichu. We have to serve the way the Eibishter, you know, the way the Eibishter set things out in life is probably the best course of action, the way we should educate, because that's the way God is doing it for us. And we find the concept spoken about in Kabbalah and Chassidus, the power of Tzimtzum. What's the power in Tzimtzum in short? God appreciated that if he is going to be too overwhelming, if he's going to allow his full intensity to be revealed, no one will be able to develop for themselves. There'll be no independent existence. The words of Chassidus is that we'll be completely bottle and completely nullified. So what did God do? God said, I got to hold back. I got to restrict myself. I don't just fully throw on everything. I don't impose. And the first things Kabbalah says happens, he made a space. He made a cholol. What's this analogy of a cholol of a space? It's a certain environment. When you are trying to explain something to a child or to a teacher trying to explain something to a student, if the child doesn't get it, you have to create the environment for the child to get it. Give them an example. Create a certain picture in their mind. Make a video. Give them a handle where they have built enough confidence in themselves that they could handle it, A. Where you've given them the space where they could handle it, and now they could actually sort of go through the example or the picture to say, ah, that's what you're referring to. So what God did for us, in order for us to be able to appreciate him and to understand how to fully be developed, to reach our full potential, is he gave us the space to allow us to come to terms with ourselves. Allow us to have a confidence that we could receive. And in those spaces, he gave us those little examples. It's like a child. When you want to explain something to a child, you don't explain it to them the way you can explain it to a 25-year-old. You explain it to them the way the child will understand. You even speak to them in baby language. Because that's the way the child will understand. It'll give them the capabilities of going there. A second major thing he did was hide in nature. Not only did God give us the space, but what he did was he also created this type of separation, this distance, where I don't necessarily see God's hand directly in nature. I have to look for it. And this created a tremendous effect on us. It creates a double edge. On the one hand, it could be a tremendous positive, but it could also be a negative. The negative is obvious. If I don't see God in nature, I'm like, why should I do Torah mitzvahs? Why should I serve him? Why should I live up to these ideals? I don't know if they're true. Who tells me that God is true? I have no way to know that what I'm living, the way I'm living my life today is true. I have no way of knowing that if I'm looking from an objective perspective. And no one could disprove to me either objectively that what I'm doing is not true. That's a different story. The point, though, is that I could become completely disenchanted with religion or any of these ideas because I don't see God in nature. But what it also enables me, besides creating my independence, if God is not showing me the whole time, he also makes me want to come closer. Because the nature of Gvura is intensity with feeling distant from something. You know, it's like the teacher that you had. You have certain teachers that they just made you want to be good in class, or they made you want to learn. They didn't do anything. It's that aloofness that they had, that element of being distant from you, where you felt like you had to catch up to them. Like, for you to speak to them or be in their presence was an honor. A certain deep respect and appreciation for who they are. And obviously this is very dangerous, and this leads to next week's discussion about dark charisma, and am I a fake or am I real? But it could be very dangerous, such types of people. But talking about a healthy type of distance, where the child begins to appreciate, you want this not because I was forced to, but there's a certain truth to it, that I realize myself, and the pull, the motivation to go there is because I have this aspiration, I want to be like my father. Not because my father is my father, but because this intensity of hiding a little bit, of making yourself a little aloof, removing yourself a little bit, where there's a certain like, wow, it's like being in the presence of Einstein, or being in the presence of the Rebbe. What's the pull there? You're like, wow. Or like someone told me last night that they questioned religion as a young boy. And they're like, why should I do? Why should I be part of it? As soon as they saw the Rebbe, all of a sudden things changed. He says, if this guy believes in it, I believe in it. The very distance is what creates the pull. And there's a lot to elaborate on this, but it's going to be too long to discuss. But the very nature of standing is sort of on a distance where the parent gives to the child, allows the child to appreciate that he is guiding, but he also makes the child feel like there's more that you should want from yourself. A certain instilling of motivation. I know for myself, and to be very honest, that my father instilled in me, and with all of my siblings, this feeling that you're good, but there's more to accomplish. And my motivation, ambition, was to accomplish what he thought was important to accomplish. And didn't come from a sense of being imposed upon me. I truly had a pride in it. Another difference I have over here between healthy and unhealthy, do you instill a pride or an ego? I had a pride in who I was. I hope I still have a pride in who I am. But a certain appreciation of this truth. It may have been that I had to go through a process of individually, independently coming to the terms of it being true. But once I realized that myself, once I saw myself that this is true, at least intuitively, I can't prove it to you rationally, then I naturally, my aspirations was to be what my father believed to be true. And that's the power of tzimtzum. And I have over here, I bring it down in the Yud Kei Vav Kei about this process of growing, of sprouting, leaving the plant alone, then nurturing the plant when it gets to a stage where it's necessary for nurturing. Direction depends. I'm not going to get into all that. I just want to finish off the last point, actualizing balance, reaching for more. Direct involvement without imposing. So I have here a number of points. The first point is you have to really instill certain morals, ethics, ideals, beliefs, giving a child a sense of truth. What do I mean by that? If a child, let's say the classic question you're going to ask, you're going out, you want to get married, you can discuss with your, whoever you're going out with, the boy, the girl to discuss. So when we're going to have a 12-year-old child that's going to rebel, how do we go about it? What do we do when we're going to come be faced with an issue where the child doesn't want to do what we have tried to impress on them to do or the direction we've given them? And a lot of times, you won't know until you actually get into that moment. You could have great ideals. You could be living in an ideal world. But in the real moment, it's very hard because, again, that instinct is you feel you have a right to decide for your child how your child should live your life. It's a topic we spoke about last week. But the point is that there is a necessity of giving the child a sense of what you believe in and making it absolutely true in the child's mind that this is truth. There's a concept by Ben Sarah Amir that the Pasuk first says that they come to Beis Din. It says that the V'loi Shomu, he didn't listen to the Koil Avi V'Koil Imei, to his father and his mother's voice. And then when they come to Beis Din, the parents say, B'neinu Zar, a child V'loi Shomu V'Koilenu, didn't listen to our voice, singular. What happened over here? So one of the ways explaining is that because originally there was a certain dissonance between the father and the mother's voice. They weren't coherent as one single body. They weren't directing as one single instrument of truth. The child therefore came a Ben Zera Meir. He came a rebellious child. And when the parents realize their mistake, then they say Koyleinu. Then they come to terms, we have to be a single force. There's a necessity for the child to know what the parents believe in to be true. You believe Shabbos is sacred and holy? Live that way as an example. Make the child be fully aware of that. But then there's a difference between instilling it, but imposing. Making the child think that if he doesn't do this, he's a bad person. Or if they don't understand why, do it anyway. Without appreciating the necessity of giving the space that we spoke about, this development space that's necessary. Instilling self-motivated individual character. Allow the child to feel that they have a uniqueness. Their approach to life is something to be cherished. They shouldn't throw away their own personality. They shouldn't throw away their relationship. Even a relationship between us and God, us and religion, it says in the Medrash that Noyde Bashur and Baila, that each person has his particular relationship with God. You should nurture his individual perspective. Don't throw it away because you were brought up differently or you feel differently or you sense differently. And encourage the uniqueness. And most importantly is making the space to merge individualism with the universal ideas. And this is really the teenage years. When the child, you try to instill in the child when they're younger certain truths. And they won't fully appreciate it till they reach the 13, 14, 15 age. And that's when they would really start beginning to rebel. Allow them to have the space to first come in tune with the way they feel. I experience this myself. A lot of questions about religion. A lot of questions about what I'm doing, is it right or not? I still question. But because I felt I was given the space to think through, to see how I relate to them, to give myself my individual perspective on it, then I could merge those universal truths that my parents were trying to instill in me and try to merge them together as a single force. Because otherwise, you're left with a cognitive dissonance. And you question yourself. You question whether, way my parents brought me up, is that the correct way? But I like something better. I feel this is not the right way. I feel miserable. I feel religion has, you know, mind the word, rape me. So if there's no appreciation of that balance of merging the two, in other words, allowing you to instill in the child the proper mode of life, giving them that perspective, pulling, not pushing, directing, but also not neglecting. And at the same time, giving them that space where they will want to become individuals, where they will want to develop. The Gemara says that to a certain age, you could instill. Afterwards, you have to let them be individuals. And this really goes for everybody within ourselves as well, just to finish off with this point. When we want to work on ourselves, when we want to perfect ourselves, when we're trying to nurture and develop, we're using the power of Gvura, the Koivish as Yitzray, the power to reach deep in within ourselves and pull out its full potential. We have to appreciate that we have to give ourselves the process, time, and space necessary. We're not looking at the goal. We don't have decisions for ourselves already. We also have to realize that we have to also stick true to beliefs. We can't throw away all morals. We can't say that what the world thinks is nonsense. However much of an unconventionalist you are, you can't say that everything that everybody else believes in is not for me. There has to be an appreciation. You have certain rebellious children that as soon as they start rebelling, they run away from everything. They deny everything because they have no identity for themselves. So they're trying to throw away any identity that they had because they're not comfortable with it. So there's an appreciation of instilling within yourself certain truths and appreciating that these principles are true. But then there's also an appreciation of how you relate to them and how they merge within you, how my unique character. God made us all different because God wanted us to be different. He wanted us to bring out his uniqueness through you. Why try to be like the other person? God didn't want you to be like the other person. But God also gave universal truths to everybody. There's the blending of them, how they work within ourselves. And the result, hopefully, from all this is that when you reach into yourself and create this tremendous appreciation, so then you have the healthy elements of Gura, where you're strategic, you're not OCD, you're passionate, you have a certain feeling and respect for yourself and for others. You know thyself and you know thy child. You understand what means me, what it stands, the individual versus the whole together. And more importantly, you bring up the next generation of healthy, educated, proper individuals serving the Eibishter. Shabbi Zoyche that says that this process of education, we know that it was a whole part here I didn't bring in about the Golos, the turn to Guzman HaGolos is really when we get this educational process, when God gives us that most freedom and individualism and independence to really nurture us. And the deeper the struggle is a deeper pull, a deeper sense of Gvura. That's the Ezehu Gibor. The greater power is only in the struggle. When we go deeper in a struggle of Golos, it really nurtures a much deeper self. And therefore, not that we're in a lower level now. We're actually reaching the pinnacle of our true complete existence now, right before Mashiach comes. And when Mashiach comes, that means we've reached that perfection. Then the true power of Gevurah, of the Eibush's Gevurah, which we know Gevurah is always is Torah. The only way we really nurture and power ourselves is through this power of Torah and nurturing ourselves. And then there'll be the full revelation, the Torah Chadosha, the new Torah, the new Ois, the new power, which will be B'bias HaMashiach Teichem Yad Mamash. Yeah. I don't want to say this, but that was when you were asleep. You'll have to listen to the recording for that one. No, you're not giving them to figure things out first. You're instilling in them ideas that you believe to be true. So what? Okay. Right. Right, right. So this is a great question. The question is, what happens if my child naturally is doing things that are in my face against what I believe? In my house, they're going to bring in a non-kosher piece of food. Or they're going to watch something, you know, on my video screen, on my computer, which is against my belief. And I'll just speak from personal experience, the way I was educated. You know, my mother was very, may she be well, she made us very aware that she wasn't comfortable with certain things we listened to or watched. But it was not about, you can't. Okay, maybe when we were 5 years old, where we didn't know the difference, at that point, which is a point I didn't really tap into, the age difference. I wanted to get into that. But there was a certain point where she's like, please have the respect for me and listen to it on your own, you know, your own machine, your own, your own devices, your own things. Don't put it in my face. In other words, you have the choice here to decide what's right and what's wrong. I try to instill what I believe. I'm trying to say this is wrong because of the fact that that's my way of life. At the end of the day, I'm leading you this direction. Have enough respect for me and enough appreciation for me that this is something that I reject as myself. You're not telling the child that they're a worthless person, a being because they struggle with it or they don't appreciate it like you. You're not throwing them out of the house. You're allowing them to appreciate that in certain environments you have to have the respect for, and that itself gives them the independence to make the choice because you're throwing the ball back in their court. What you're really telling them is saying, here, I know that you're struggling with it. I can't force you to do it. But you decide for yourself, what do you really want in life? How much does it mean to you to have to watch this movie? How much does it mean to you to become something and live the way you want? And probably the teenager from 13 to 17 will probably do what they shouldn't do. Okay, so here really comes another question, and that's a... Right. Okay, so there is a concept in halacha that if you see someone doing something wrong, whether they're their child or not your child, you have to stop them. You have to be moicha at least once. You have to tell them they can't. But you have to also appreciate that you do your bit. You make it clear to them that you don't approve of this. You don't hit them. You don't. It's maybe very difficult as a child, as a father, to see your child knowing they're going to do what they're going to do. But there is a limitation of what you could do. Beis Din has a right to maybe be koyfet to force certain people to do certain things in certain ways. And that's an issue theologically, how they have a right to do that. But as us, as a parent, and thinking about Mechal Shabbos Achas Kedei Sheyishmer Shabbos Yisharbe, I know that if I give them the space now, they may transgress this Avera. Shabbos, the greatest thing, in order that eventually they'll come to a point where they'll appreciate themselves, versus forcing them this Shabbos, and they'll violate all the rest of the Shabbosim. Right. Correct.
So, does a parent just say, you know what, don't do this in front of my, in the kitchen or something like this?
I mean, I think there's a number of points here that really should be discussed. First of all, you have to appreciate the personality of the child. how they react to certain pieces. If the child is more of an intellectual, you have to speak to them intellectually. You have to explain to them rationally. You have to give them an understanding. You can't just say, don't do. Why not to do? Right? So there's a necessity to hear them out and to discuss. If the child is more of an emotional person, maybe you could tell them a story about Shabbos or about these things. So it's first relating to them. But I would say what's really important, and I know this is more of takes a lot on the father's end, the intuitive side of knowing thy child, is really understanding what's the motivation. No child wants to naturally disobey his parents. There's something that triggered it. So then we have to find it out. A lot of the issues today with the phone is the texting. Texting has become an addiction, right? There's a, what is it called? It's a phobia. This is already given a certain psychological description of not having your cell phone and not being able to text. It stimulates certain endorphins in the brain, and that you need it. It's a drug. And therefore, there's a necessity to appreciate beyond just the particular struggle what's the causes of the struggle. And, you know, you have people, let's say, you know, even if you're married, or let's say your daughter is 15, 16, 17, and they want to wear makeup on Shabbos because they don't feel comfortable walking outside on the street. They think they look ugly. So they're going to hide, and they're going to put on makeup. And you're going to tell them, you're Michal Shabbos, you're the biggest rusher, you're going to get burned in hell. You're not focusing on the issue. The issue is not about, they feel the same guilt. They're bothered by the same issues you're bothered with, but they can't. They're trapped by this fear of people looking at them and not loving them or not appreciating them or thinking they look ugly. So there's a necessity to focus on the problem and to try to understand it. Now, as a parent, again, this is the hardest thing because you're in the moment and you don't want your child to go against Shabbos. You don't want your child or your spouse or anyone to do something that in your presence or knowing that you have the power to change to do it, right? And there is a concept of spearing the rod is spoiling the child. If you're not going to be firm and strong, the Rebbe has a whole sikha about this idea, let's say, when it comes especially to the topic of sexuality and all that. The Rebbe is very strong. He says, don't finagle it. You know, don't try to make the issue parav. It's very strict. It's very strong. And it, and the end result is, if you're not careful, especially, let's say, about matters of sexuality, it usually brings it to the child being having struggles with it when they get older. If it's not fully, as a child, certain things need to be fully ingrained. But even then, there's a method of making and not breaking. You know, I don't know if there's one answer for everybody. I think it's an individual, each parent understanding their child and relating to their particular issues of what's the motivation behind their struggle. And only then could they actually begin a course of action. You obviously try whatever you could in the most positive, you know, coaxing positive way to coax them in not doing. But at the end of the day, you have to appreciate that you can't force them. God doesn't force us either. God doesn't say, you do an avera, boom, I'll throw a lightning strike at you and kill you. He gives us the chance to sin and to fail. That's it?
I got one question.
Yeah.
You know this thing about goal-oriented?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there's a specific, you know, verse or quote that I could say this. There's a number of statements in the Gemara, if you want sources I could give you. The general idea is that we see the way the journey that the Yidden had in the desert. God had a very strong understanding of the process. For example, right away it says when he took them out of Egypt, he says, "V'leinochem derech plishtim." He didn't lead them in the path of the plishtim. He understood they weren't ready for this challenge. He didn't expect from them to all of a sudden, he wanted them to go into Eretz Yisrael, right? That was his objective, that was his goal. But he let the goal go by for a greater necessity. He wanted them to go into Eretz Yisrael right away. He gave them 40 years to develop their maturity to get there. So the goal was maybe an overwhelming, on the back burner force, a impetus to push them to where you want them to go. But that wasn't the forefront of his mind, so to speak, is that objective. Or let's say we find even by the flood, God made the great flood and God says, you know what, I can't do this. That's not the way the world is going to run because I want my goal to be to make, you know, God's knowledge known in the world. People are people. Therefore, there's an appreciation of that. So there's a number of cases we could find in Sintar. He gave them time. In other words, the goal doesn't become... It's not as if you don't have expectations for your child. You don't have them wanting to go somewhere, but you don't make it the focus. When it's on your mind that this is what you want your child to be doing, and then that's always there. So it's like the person that their objective is that I want to hit the home run. So you'll never... You'll strike out. What? Yeah, but we spoke about what punishments really mean. Punishments are development. Gvura is a process of developing. Sometimes you have to take away the knife when the child is going to hold a knife and he may cut himself. There's a point in appreciating. I don't know what you call punishment. There's no words in the Torah that describes punishment. There's no word oynish in the Torah. It just says there's a concept of kapara. It's not oynish. You know? But that's an appreciation, though, that we were not ready to go into Eretz Yisrael, right? So even though God wants... Yeah. Yeah. Right.